Yes, to go ahead now with what you were saying, you were in Cairo then when the Secretary General came to meet with Nasser and to make this appeal for a moratorium. What was your impression of Utan's mood and attitude at this particular point?
Well, he was extremely depressed, extremely sad. I believe that, of course, you know, Utan is a very religious man, very peaceful man, very kind man, and he agreed to the withdrawal of UNEF-1 in good faith, thinking that somehow things may peace may be maintained. And now, with his conversation with Nasser, he realized that war was almost inevitable. But he didn't want to believe in war. That's why, in fact, he went to see Nasser with General Ricci, because Ricci was the force commander of UNEF-1. And then he met with Bull. And at 11 o'clock, when I was going to bed, suddenly he called me. He said, "Effie, could you come to my room?" And I saw him alone. And he was very sad, in a confiding mood. I said, well, he was hoping that peace could be preserved. Now he's less sure. But he still didn't want to, he still want to hope mm-hmm. that peace could be preserved. He said, well, I think I want to call for a moratorium. Moratorium may not be the right word for this situation, but for him it is, see, because it's like a bank, you see, and you could extend the moment of truth so that he could find some way of making an agreement.
And this concept of moratorium that he had, that was simply, in a sense, a standstill on all fronts, is that?
That's right. For them not to take any action which would lead to actual war, to active war.
Which would have meant not stopping any Israeli ship going through the Strait of Tehran.
Yes, and not to increase the troop movement at the border, not to make irresponsible statements, something. But at that time, he wanted to gain time.
And when he left Cairo, did you have the impression that he felt that he had succeeded to some extent?
No, he knew, because the main thing, it was quite simple. It was the closure of Gulf of Aqaba.
That was it.
That was it. And when Nasser took the decision, refused to reverse the decision, it became hopeless. But he still hoped that something might happen. The Deus ex machina.
But you had to anticipate at that point that there would be war and that the Israelis would not stand back.
Yeah, at that time. The Israelis made quite clear. They used the word, the Latin expression, casus belli, to emphasize the point.
And of course, we know the outcome of that. Now, going ahead to the outcome, were you still in Jerusalem, or were you back in New York at the time when the Security Council was meeting and when Resolution 242 was eventually adopted?
Yes, I was in New York, and in fact, I saw Karadan, Lord Karadan, discussing with staff about changing of some word to get resolution adopted. And I was in the Security Council chamber when the resolution was adopted. The whole room broke into a loud applause. It never happened before, well, not in my memory. It was like all the members, all the persons in the council room, so that finally we could have a peace agreement. Of course, that hope was to be frustrated.
Now, this is known, of course, as the British draft. Was there any input from the Secretariat that you know of in the drafting?
No. You know, we normally, on this very crucial question, would not want to put on any input unless asked. But that resolution was prepared by the British delegation. In fact, I was near Lord Clarendon when he told his staff, try to reword the resolution to have it adopted unanimously.
Now, to your knowledge, was the resolution, though, subjected to what I would call a legal examination by the legal department of the Secretariat? The reason I ask this question is, was the significance of the absence of the word "the" recognized at that point in front of the occupied territory?
At that time, I don't think it was recognized. It was recognized later when Yaring started his negotiation.
So the subtlety of that was, if that was the intention of the British draft, and I suppose it was not recognized immediately.
Then. I don't think so. And also, when you consider a resolution, so on, each delegation considered the resolution in one language. I don't think that many resolutions will compare the text and so on. It is assumed that the translation is right. So the resolutions, mainly the original, was in the English text. Withdrawal from occupied territory without the D. And the French considered the text in their language with the le, des territoires. In fact, you see, the problem is that you can't translate exactly, because the French cannot say this, it would be bad French, you see. And therefore you need something. You need either from the territories or from certain territories. The would be too much, certain would be not enough. But the French didn't realize that. The French text was drafted in very good French. So the English text was quite good, and there was no problem, and the translation sections didn't pay much attention to it. It came later. In fact, it became an issue because the political will was absent. Otherwise, it doesn't really matter. But when the political will is not there, then you look for reasons to disagree.
I wanted to go ahead now to Mr. Yaring and his mission. Could you give a kind of a personal assessment of Mr. Yaring and of his efforts to bring about a peace settlement?
Well, Yaring is a very good diplomat, very hardworking, very thorough. He tried everything possible. And he was helped by the major powers, at one time the four major powers, except China, met regularly in order to foster his efforts. He was helped by the Africans. There was a high-level African mission, the mission of four African presidents, led by Sandor. He went in the area to help him. So he had many assets. And at the end, he arrived at the right conclusion, which is that the problem has to be dealt with seriatim, first in the Egyptian sector, and later on going into the Jordanian sector and the Syrian sector. So he started with the Egyptian sector. And he proposed, as you know, exchange of territory for recognition. Withdrawal from also, in order to make the problem less complicated, he dealt with Sinai, not with Gaza, which was part of Palestine. So the withdrawal of Israeli troops from the Sinai in exchange with recognition. The Egyptian accepted, Israel rejected it. And that was the end of the Yaring effort. But that is same proposal was taken up by Kissinger and led to the peace treaty. The problem with Yang that he doesn't have the clout of a major power.
Right. Now, I wanted to ask in this connection, again, the relationship between a negotiator like that, a mediator, Yaring, and headquarters in New York. Was he being given guidance, continuing guidance from the Secretary General, or was he largely independent in his efforts?
Well, he was not tele-guided, mm-hmm. But he himself consulted the Secretary General and Bunch very often. He came to New York, and they worked very closely.
Now, in the course of time, when it came to 1970, there had been the war of attrition on the Egyptian-Israeli front. Yaring was able to arrange a ceasefire at that point. Was that his personal?
I think that really the U.S. arranged the ceasefire in order to facilitate the Yaring mission, mm-hmm. the resumption of the Yaring mission. I think the main role was played by the U.S.
So that, in fact, again, you needed a major power to to do it.
Yes.
But this this ceasefire did hold.
Yes.
For a while.
Yeah, it did hold until October 73. In fact, the biggest surprise, the eruption of the October War, the October War was a big surprise for everyone because the situation was very quiet, almost normal because you have some exchange of fire, but that was very normal, you see. The situation extremely quiet, and the Israeli authorities didn't believe there would be the war at that time. For the first time, they were surprised. They were taken aback.
Now, the outcome, of course, of that war is known also. In the process of trying to achieve a ceasefire and eventually a disengagement, Henry Kissinger was in touch with the Secretary General. How would you describe the relationship between Kissinger as the major negotiator at that point and the Secretary at the United Nations and Waldheim?
It was good. It was good. In fact, Kissinger, I think when Kissinger played an important role in the U.S. administration, I believe at the beginning he didn't believe too much in the U.N. But with the October War and the aftermath, he came to see the usefulness of the U.N., and he used the U.N. In a very skillful way.
In particular, are you referring to the talks at Kilometer 101, that this was...
First, 101, the talks in 101, that's U.N., you see. It was chaired by Silas Wu and so on. That was UN. That was UN. Only later, you have the second negotiation, which dealing with the disengagement, the partial disengagement. That was Kissinger, which led to another disengagement negotiation. And what he did is that he would have the chateau between the two parties. And in the chateau, you can really not go into great detail. So he would seek an agreement in broad terms and then pass it to the UN. And then the UN will discuss the detailed arrangements.
Right. Now, in his memoirs, Kissinger has said that he has stressed the importance of the talks at Kilometer 101. But he said that he never knew quite what was happening because he got different reports from the UN, from the Israelis, and from the American observer there. What was the reporting procedure on the UN side from Kilometer 101.
You mentioned the American observers.
Yeah.
That's the American observers of UNSA.
Well, I think there weren't there also an American observer actually at the talks. I mean, from the U.S. government.
Oh, see. Yes.
Yeah, not the military observer.
Yeah,
but
that's right. Yes. Well, you see, the same thing can see is seen by different people with slightly different light. That is normal, because the perspectives are different for each. But I think essentially it must be same. But I would say that on the talks at kilometer 101, the main source, the original source, is the UN. You see, and therefore the UN has a certain viewpoint, but we organize it, we chaired it.
And James Jonah was there as...
James Jonah was sent there to advise Silas.
Yes. He was a kind of a political advisor.
That's right. He's the political advisor. A little bit the same as I was sent to advise Bull in 67.
And so Jonah really was responsible for reporting back what had happened.
I'm sure, yes. I'm sure that Silas and Jonah think in the same way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. In fact, when the so-called peace conference was then organized in Geneva, the Secretary General, who by now is Mr. Waldheim, opened the conference, but that was his only role. Is that your impression?
That's right. Yes, that the Geneva conference was mainly sponsored by the U.S. and USSR, but the Secretary General was asked to invite the parties to and to open the negotiations, and of course the UN is there.
Now, was it your impression from the perspective of headquarters that General Silasuo and his staff were able actually to contribute to the successful achievement of the implementation of the ceasefire and ultimately the disengagement agreement? Was there a substantive UN contribution to this?
Oh, yes. His role is very important. You see, I know that Kissinger had an agreement in Bolton. Let's take the more difficult of the two, that's between Israel and Syria.
Right.
So Syria was the enemy. When the Kissinger got the agreement on board, and that was very important, then meetings, direct negotiations, took place within the military commission of the Geneva Conference. You see, in fact, they used this channel. When the peace conference was opened in Geneva in December, 73, they had just a few meetings, then they adjourned with that. But the military committee, that is a military committee with Israeli and Egyptian representative and the UN, you see, and chaired by Silasuo, remained in function. And that matter was dealt with by the military committee. So with the Israeli, Egyptian, and of course, the Syrian representatives sent there especially for the purpose, but chaired by Silasuo and with Jonah as advisor. And they pinpointed all the problems to be resolved and made the detailed arrangements.
Including the geographic pinpointing, I believe.
Oh, yes, that's right. Yes.
And in effect, the UN then could assist in the technical aspects of the agreement which was under negotiation, but you are suggesting that they also could provide a substantive input by ideas of how difficulties could be overcome?
Oh, yes.
And General Silasuo was quite expert in the area by this time, is that correct?
Yes, but he was in UNSO Then he was a commander of UNIF 2, and he was very good.
I was going to ask if you could give your impression of the effectiveness of General Silasfor at this point, which because he was in a very crucial role.
That's right. He played a very crucial role, and he's a general with a political mind too, which is important. No, he played a very important role.
Because I wanted to depart a little bit here from the 73 war on this question of the military commanders, because in the recent study you did for the International Peace Academy, you've pointed to the fact that the quality of the force commanders varied in the history of peacekeeping. Some were good and some were not so good. Are there instances in this history that we've been talking about where the quality of the force commander made a real difference?
I think so. Well, I must say that all the very successful operations were led by very good generals. UNIF 1 owed much to General Burns, who was the force commander. And UNIF 2 owed very much to Silas. The force commander in time of crisis, a good force commander is essential in time of crisis. It's not important when there is no crisis. UNSO, for instance, in a number of many years, UNSO was just a presence, and the role is not too significant. So there, if you have a less good general, it doesn't matter that much. In fact, too active a general would be a handicap. And I know that Israel doesn't want to. They just wanted presence with a general which they could handle easily. Of course, we need a general who will not let the parties handle him.
Yes.
But there, that is not difficult. But to have a good general who could take major decisions, that is very important. I mentioned Burns for UNIF 1, Sidas for UNIF 2. I should mention Prem Chand. In Cyprus, there was a big crisis when the Turkish army entered. I don't want to invade it because the Turkish government doesn't like the word, or took military action against Cyprus. They, of course, immediately took over quite a lot of land. And they want to take the airport of Nicosia. That was very important, because Nicosia was the capital. And if they took the airport, the balance would be changed drastically. And he got the British, we have a British battalion, to have some heavy equipment. Some heavy, I think, those are Stinger missiles, and he positions the international organized troops at the airport, and resisted the Turkish forces, and the Turks never took the airport.
And this was General Prem Chand who was there at that point,
who had been in
Katanga.
And also in Katanga, without Prem Chand and his troops, we might not have resolved the problem of the Katanga secession.
So you would say that the United Nations has been fortunate in the quality of the force commanders in the major peacekeeping operations, except perhaps partly in the Congo.
Yeah, in the Congo and... That's right, yes, I would say that. From time to time, you have less good generals, as I said in my... I really don't want to names, but that happens everywhere. But in the UN, I think we need a very good general, particularly for crucial operations.
Now, I wanted to return now to the question of the military observers and UNSO. And I wanted to ask whether you felt from the perspective, again, of headquarters, the presence of U.S. and Soviet observers when that occurred made any difference. Was it an advantage or a disadvantage or simply made no difference at all?
It didn't make much difference. But there is a political advantage, obviously. It was a proposal, a joint proposal by the U.S. and the USSR to have them. It was imposed on the Secretary General, and the Secretary General had to accept it. But I think it's a small price to pay to get the support of the two superpowers. The continued support of the U.S. and the new support of the USSR. In fact, the USSR changed the position very much at that time, you see, which led to Gorbachev's dramatic change in 86.
Which would take me back to a question about a much earlier period, which you mentioned a little earlier yourself, and that is, why did Hammarskjöld take the decision that U.S. and Soviet forces should not be included in peacekeeping operations?
I really, I can only guess. First, I think that force would be, in his mind, very different from the force under Chapter 7. In the Chapter 7, that force was mainly based on the support and the participation of the major powers. He wanted a force without the major powers. And also, since that conflict involved the two major powers inside, he thought it was good not to have any major powers. In fact, in one of his first reports, he said that there was three ways of planning the force. Copying the Korean matter, that is, give that to one country, probably one major power, and he didn't think that was advisable. Or to give this to the two major powers already there, since they said that they went there in order to maintain law and order. And he saw that that too was not a major power. So he preferred a new force, you see, in which relying on the small and major, medium powers without major power involvement. I think we have to eat now because we have to do, we have to